Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're going to be in 1 Samuel today. We're going to be dealing with chapter 18. Chapter 18 is the beginning of the conflict between David and Saul and the tremendous friendship between David and Jonathan. Now, back in 17 and 16, back through there, is where David, as the youngest son of Jesse, has been chosen by Samuel, but no one knows. He's been anointed by Samuel. No one knows. He goes out and hears Goliath taunting the armies of Israel and says, "I'll take on that uncircumcised bully." And boy, he does. Well, after all that is done, we're coming back in chapter 18. The Philistines have been routed after the battle and the spoils are collected. Now they're back at the Israeli camp, and Saul says, "Who was that masked man?" And so they bring David in, and I'm sure Abner brought him in and said, "This is the young man that killed Goliath." And so Saul, I'm sure, sits down with Jonathan at his side, and they begin to talk. And this conversation about David and where he was born and who he was and what he dreams and what he wants is what we pick up in chapter 18, verse 1. "Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself." Now, against the backdrop of this tremendous Philistine rout, I want to take just a moment to set the stage of who the Philistines are. And I have a graphic I'd like to show you. Notice, if you would, they're Aegean people, which means they're probably from one of the islands of the Aegean, maybe Cyprus, maybe Crete, maybe some of the other islands. They were the only uncircumcised people in the whole area. I want you to notice they tried to invade Egypt around 1100 B.C., but were defeated. And so they settled on the southwestern coast of Palestine about the time the Israelis were entering the Promised Land. They were the only people in this area who had Iron Age technology. They're the only ones who had metal weapons. And also, they totally assimilated Canaanite culture. And by that I mean they took the Canaanite gods, they took the Canaanite forms of polity. They even took over the Canaanite political structures. There were five lords of the Philistines in the five major cities of the Philistines. So the Canaanites had city-states, and that's what we continue then. Now, after the rout of the Philistines here, they're sitting down at the campfire, and it says, when he finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan, this is the word nephesh. Now, nephesh and the word for spirit, ruah, are really hard to lock down the Old Testament, as they are in the New Testament, suke and pneuma. Those are the Greek words, nephesh and ruah, the Hebrew words. It's very hard to know exactly what's being referred to. They seem to be almost synonymous. Now, in the Old Testament, in Genesis, where God forms man out of the red clay of the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley and breathes into him the breath of life, and man became a living nephesh. Now, that sounds awful neat until about two chapters over it says that the cows have a nephesh. So we're not real sure exactly the uniqueness of man's nephesh. It seems to be his animal life, some translators say, physical life, personhood maybe. Here it seems to be personhood, personality. The soul of Jonathan was knit. Now, this is used one other time in the Bible. It's used in Genesis 49:30. For Jacob's love for his youngest son, Benjamin, as recorded by one of the other brothers. The youngest son was a favorite of the old man, and the other boys knew it. This describes something of the friendship bond between Ruth and Naomi in Ruth chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. Now, some have said this is a homosexual relationship. Well, friends, David's going to get married in this chapter. I do not think there's anything here about homosexuality except in the heart of people who read this and are looking for something to support their own perverted lifestyles. I'm sorry, I see nothing here of the possibility of homosexuality. What I see here is deep, abiding friendship to the point of laying down your life for someone else. I've had friends like that. Have you? Someone that has an immediate rapport with. Someone you love almost better than you do life itself. Matter of fact, that's what is said about Jonathan. In chapter 20, verse 17, it says he loves him more than life himself. Here in verse 1, it says he loves him as himself. And in 2 Samuel 1:26, it says he loves him more than the love of a woman. And I guess that's where some folks have thought this was maybe a homosexual thing. But that passage in a poetic section, it just describes the intensity the depth of the friendship and commitment and companionship that these two men had. Ruth and Naomi had the same kind of companionship. Nobody accuses them of being homosexual. So I think it's just ridiculous, that kind of modern statement used here. Now, when it says loved him, and the soul of David was, and Jonathan loved him as himself, I want to say a word to you about self-love. I think one of the greatest needs in our day is a positive self-image. Oh, friends, if we could just help people appreciate who they are in God, that God has created them the way they are for a purpose, if there's no accident in God's creation. I want to tell you what. You are somebody. And if you don't have a positive self-love, I don't know how you're going to love me as you do yourself. Friends, tell you the truth, I don't want you loving me as most of you love you, because I think I deserve better than that. We're going to have a positive self-image in who we are in Jesus Christ before we can love our neighbor as ourselves. I think that's very important. Now, notice if you would in verse 2. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Now, if you look back in chapter 17, 15, David kept going back and forth. But Saul recognized the quality of this young man and wanted him to be part of his military, apparently his armor bearer. Now in verse 3, and then Jonathan made a covenant, a bereath, with David because he loved him as himself. Now the word covenant here is very significant. If you'll look at the rest of this chapter, and especially chapter 23, verse 17, the covenant here seems to involve much more than a friendship bond, much more than even a political or religious covenant. What we have here is a covenant that seems to say that Jonathan loved him enough to lay down his right to the throne and say, David, you're the man, not me. God's chosen you, and I know it. You're the one to succeed my father, not me. Now, there's a bond of love here that's just very, very strong. Now, notice, if you would, where in verse 4, and Jonathan stripped himself of the robe, definite article. And this, I think, was a robe that symbolized that he was the prince, okay, crown prince. That was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword, his bow, and his belt. Now, remember I told you that the Philistines were the only one who had iron weapons. We learned from chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, verses 19 and 22, that the only people in Saul's army that had metal swords was Saul and Jonathan. Now, think what kind of a gift Jonathan just gave David. He gave him one of the only two metal swords. That's like our most highly technological military equipment given to someone else. Now, you see the analogy there? The robe, the crown prince robe, his armor. That was a tremendous covenant they made, far, far wider than just a friendship bond. Notice in verse 5 how David appealed to other people. And so David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul set him over the men of war. So David was loved and liked and very popular by the military. And look what it says here. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people. The populace loved him. You see the same thing in verse 16. And so in the sight of Saul's servants. Friends, even the bureaucracy loved him. And when the governmental bureaucracy loves you, you some kind of fella, I want you to know. Now, notice here in verse 6. And it happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistine. Now, it seems to refer to Goliath, but it must refer to the military campaigns in verse 5, because Goliath doesn't fit here. And the women came out of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. This was a very common occurrence for the virgins of Israel to welcome back the men of war. You might want to see Judges 11:34. It's in Exodus 15:20 and 21, Psalm 68:25, Psalms 149:3. It was just a traditional way of welcoming the troops back. Remember when the troops, you seen the pictures that came home from World War I and II, the people lined the streets and gave them a ticker tape parade kind of thing? Well, this is the Israeli counterpart of that, if you please. Now, the singing and dancing. I hope you have a Bible dictionary. I wish you'd look up dancing. Dancing is an act of worship to the Jewish people. Now, it says David danced naked before the Lord. You can't take the Bible literally in all places. But dancing was an expression. You ever see Sit Fiddler on the Roof? That poor Jewish man as he dances in his barn for joy and knowing God. I wish Protestants and Roman Catholics could catch that. Catch the joy of faith that livens up life in every aspect. That our worship could be feast and praise and joy. Oh, how I wish it could be that. I think it was in Israel. It is. Now, to meet kings, tambourines, the word musical instruments, we're not sure what it means, but the root in Hebrew means three. So some think it's a trident or a three-stringed instrument. We're just not sure. But the problem with this and why it's mentioned is the women are singing as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his ten thousands. Uh-oh. The age gap is right here. Old King Saul and young upstart David. And not only is it young upstart David, but earlier the Spirit's been taken from Saul because of his rebellion and placed on David. Look at verse 8. And Saul became very angry for this saying, displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David ten thousands, but to me they ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but my kingdom? And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. Now it wasn't because of David's unfaithful acts, it's because of other people's words. Friends, I want to tell you, you better quit listening to what other folks say about other people and judging other people by what other people say. Saul is paranoid. He is jealous. And I want to show you a graphic on the life of Saul and what happens to him in this personality struggle with David. And we see it all the way through this chapter here. I want you to note, first of all, that Saul was rejected. First of all, he offered a sacrifice, and he wasn't supposed to. Samuel was, in 1 Samuel 13, 12, and 13. Then he spared Agag, one of the kings of the surrounding nations, and he was supposed to kill everybody, 15, 20, and 23. Then it says, the evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul. We see it in 1 Samuel 16, 13 and 14, and 19:9, and it's mentioned in Judges 9, 23. Then in Isaiah 45, 7, it talks about that all things come from God. You can see the paranoia pretty clear in this chapter where at one point he loves David, at one point he hates David, at one point he fears David, at one point he dreads David. And that's what we have. In my Bible, I put pink on all the places where Saul's paranoia shows. Look at all that pink in there, will you? Think you can see it? See all that pink? That's every place that David is upset. I mean, Saul's upset with David. Now, let's see, verse 10. Then it came about the next day that the evil spirit of the Lord came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house. Now, this evil spirit of the Lord, that is a hard thing to talk about. I'll give you my opinion, but I'm not 100% sure that I've got a handle on this. In the Old Testament, there's only one causality because there's only one God. This deal of monotheism says there's one God. He's in charge of all things. Now, what we have here is an example of God being in control both of good and evil. You know, evil had to be created by God because there's only one creator. But the real question is, how do we handle this when it comes into the problems of life, when it comes into the birth defects and tornadoes and disease and evil and demon possession, and on and on? Was Saul a Christian that was demon possessed? I do not know if Saul was a true believer. It seems, how could God not pick a true believer to be king? And God did pick him. I think we have an example here of a man that started out with good intentions but had tremendous personality faults. And when he rebelled against God, the personality idiosyncrasies were accentuated and came to the point that they thwarted God's ability to communicate and use this man the way he wanted to. Now, what we have here, the evil spirit is the Old Testament's way of saying that Saul had tremendous personality problems. You say, are you saying all personality problems are the evil spirit from the Lord? No, I'm not saying that. I'm in a very Old Testament context where all causality is God. Now, this evil spirit is seen in Judges 9:23. I think the theological passage I'll go to is Isaiah 45:7, that God is the cause of all things ultimately. Even evil only exists in the will of God. Friends, nothing exists out of the will of God. There is a purpose even for evil, as we see in Job chapter 1. Now, what that purpose is ultimately, I do not know. But I think we see that here. Now, the word raved is the same root word as the word prophesy. So what Saul was doing was prophesying. Well, I want to tell you, the prophets acted a little strange back through here. You know, in the New Testament it says, be filled with the Spirit, not drunk with wine. Well, that implies that being filled with the Spirit, there are some peculiarities to that. I want to tell you, these prophets of old, they flat jumped around. If you want to see it, you'll see chapter 19, verses 18 through 24. If you want to see it earlier than that, you can see it in Elijah and Elisha in the prophet guild. Now, Saul, in this chapter 19, he goes to try to catch David, and guess what happens? the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and he prophesies before the Lord naked all day. Friends, you can get a bad sunburn that way, I want you to know. And so there's the root of that. Now, notice that David was playing on his harp. Does music soothe you? Oh, it does me. It's a beautiful relaxer for me. And so that, apparently, David's playing on the harp was a soothing effect. But Saul said a spear was in Saul's hand. Now, this is the symbol of Saul's kingship. We find it over and over through here. Notice in chapter 18, verse 10, chapter 22, verse 6, a symbol of his kingship was that spear. And he's going to try to kill David. He gets so mad and so jealous. He just goes berserk. He goes into rages, manic depressiveness, paranoia par excellence. And so it says he tried to pin him to the wall, which means he tried to kill him. Now, he's going to try to kill him in verse 17, 21, and 25 by sending him off to battle, to die in battle, just like David did to Uriah. Now, this reminds me so much of the Sanhedrin. Here is supposed to be God's representative on earth trying to either kill somebody himself or have him killed. There seems to be no guilt. That's just what the Sanhedrin did with Jesus. They said, oh, he's breaking the Sabbath law. Then they have no qualms whatsoever in premeditated murder. Aren't we funny folk? I'll tell you what. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him and had departed from Saul. Boy, what a commentary. Saul removed him from his presence, verse 13. Said, just get out of the house. But when he did that, David got even more popular. Verse 14, and the Lord was with him. You ought to see chapter 16, verse 13, where it said the Spirit of the Lord came upon David. So David is in the place of blessing. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him, feared him. Notice in verse 16, and all Israel and Judah loved David. Now, the word for David is made up from a root word in Hebrew for love. So to say love David is really a play on the words. Now, in verse 17, my hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. And there's where you see Saul is planning. And the trick he's going to use is the marrying off of one of his daughters. Now, his oldest daughter is mentioned through here. She's mentioned in 17, Merbah. And he made a promise back in 1725 that the one who killed Goliath, Saul would give his daughter. Now it's come time to do that. And what Saul's going to say is, you've got to buy her from me. Now, that sounds so funny to us, but these ancient cultures, a gift, or a dowry had to be given, paid to the father of the bride. And so Saul says, I want you to go fight the Philistines. But David doesn't really catch what Saul's doing. And David says, I'm a poor man. I can't pay that price. I'm sorry. Now, either verse 19 is one of two things. Verse 19 is a refusal of David to pay the price that Saul wants. And verse 18 seems to imply that. Or verse 19 is a slap in David's face by giving his wife to be to someone else. And I'm not real sure which one it is. Now, the man mentioned here, Adriel, he's a person from the area of Gilead. And you ought to read chapter 11, because Saul had a wonderful relationship with the people of Gilead. And that's what we have here. Now, in verse 20, Michal, Saul's younger daughter, loves David. And Saul hears about it, and he makes the deal to David again. And Saul thought, I will give her to him, that she would become a snare to him. It wasn't because he wanted David to be a part of his family. He wanted him dead. That the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David, for a second time, you may be my son-in-law today. Now the word second time, by adding one consonant to the Masoretic text, we get the words within 2 years. Now I think, looking down at verse 26, where it says, before the days had expired. Apparently, Saul said, I'll give my daughter in marriage to the one who kills Goliath. Now, apparently, there was a time limit in there about paying the dowry. Now, Saul said, I want 100 foreskins of the Philistines. The Philistines were the only uncircumcised people that we know of in the whole Mediterranean area. So instead of a scalp, like American Indians took, this was taking their foreskins. Yuck. What a deal. But anyway, there was a time limit involved, and we see the second time limit in verse 26. And I think we see it in verse 21 with the change of that Hebrew letter there, the addition of it. So Saul tries to convince David, and things still, he didn't still seem too responsive. So in 22, 23, and 24, Saul says, go tell David that everybody just loves him, thinks he's so cute, he's so adorable. And David listened and said, oh, really? They think I'm cute and adorable? Well, maybe I'll go ahead and do it then. Friends, there's a lot of psychology going on through here. And so David says, all right, I'll do it. And look at verse 25. Thus you say to David, the king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Now, notice in verse 27. David rose up, went he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins and gave them in full number to the king. David said, if he wants 100, I'll give him 200. Now, this is recorded in 2 Samuel 3:4, where it says just 100. But I don't think there's a misprint of numbers here. I just think David did twice as much as Saul wanted. It's kind of like trying to make your father-in-law really think you're something by bringing 200 instead of 100. David has a little of the hot dog in him. He really does. He had a good heart, but God's the one that saw that good heart. Most folks saw a little hot dog in the king. That he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for his wife. Now, if you follow the story through the historical books, she was taken away and given to another man later. What a problem David had in his family. His own kids are going to turn out so, so disruptive. When Saul saw, that's hard to say, and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David, and thus Saul was David's enemy continually. You see the personality, the idiosyncrasies, the character being set. And in verse 30, then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so his name was highly esteemed. David was blessed by God. He was a very good military tactician. He was a very powerful leader of men, a very charismatic man. Everybody loved David. Now, I think you can see something of Saul's paranoia here. Saul was afraid to fight the giant himself. David killed the giant. Saul then found out that he was a wonderful guy, and he found out that Saul's own son loved him better than life himself. And then, lo and behold, Saul's people started loving him. Saul's military started loving him. Saul's bureaucrats started loving him. Lo and behold, Saul's daughters started loving him. Now, do you see a little bit of why you think Saul might have had some grounds for being threatened? Now, I don't think David really was out to get Saul's kingship. We see a whole different David that's unwilling to touch God's anointed later on. I don't think David recognized what he was doing, but the old man did, and boy, he was getting more and more paranoid. Everybody he loved, loved David. Everybody he trusted, they trusted David. And so I think we can see something here of the background. It all goes back to the earlier chapters of 1 Samuel, where Saul rebelled against God and did things that God told him not to do, things he knew was inappropriate. He did it anyway. And it says the Spirit of the Lord left Saul and came to David, and the evil Spirit of the Lord came upon Saul. It's almost like in the Old Testament. God's Spirit is a power that comes upon people to energize them for ministry, physical feats, spiritual feats, all kinds of things. But it leaves them at points. It is not an indwelling presence as the new covenant, but it's a presence that comes upon someone and leaves. And that's what I think we see through here. I guess the hardest theological problem I had to deal with was Saul really a believer? And the reason I think that's a difficult question to answer is we forget that there is a different relationship between the nation of Israel to some extent and the church. We talk about, are you saved? They talked about, are you part of the covenant community? Now, I think that in both covenants, Old Testament, New, there is a corporate identity and an individual response. I see that in the New Testament. We magnify the individual too much and forget the corporate. We are the believing community as they were the believing community. But the reason, it's almost like saying apples and oranges, trying to say, was Saul a committed follower of Yahweh? Well, I think he was, or God wouldn't have called him as king. I think it is impossible for me to believe that God would have called an unbeliever or an unfaithful man. Now, maybe through Saul's ignorance of what God wanted, maybe the power, and you know power is one of the things that just corrupts even believers. I believe one reason more Christians aren't wealthy is many Christians can't handle it, just cannot handle it. Maybe that was Saul's problem. He got so into this that he felt threatened. He wanted to establish a dynasty. God wanted a man that was bendable and flexible for him. The evil spirit, I don't think that's anything to do with demon possession like in the New Testament. I think it has to do with there's two powers that pull man. We see them in the Garden of Eden. We see God in full fellowship walking and talking to man, and we see the serpent saying, God didn't tell you quite the truth. God doesn't want you to be like him. Those two pulls, a pull toward God and his will and a pull toward self, a pull toward what's best for me and mine, has always been a pull to man. You can certainly see this in Saul. God called him, but Saul wanted to magnify himself. Saul wanted to do his own thing. And the result of that was that he became completely estranged from God, completely cut off from the joy of God's presence. Now, David's going to sin later. David's going to do as horrendous of things, as ungodly of things as Saul. But David is going to repent in turn. And Saul just keeps on getting deeper and deeper into this rebellious cycle. I guess it's a beautiful passage. We're going to be in 2 Samuel next time, 2 Samuel 5 and 7. I wish you'd read the rest of 1 Samuel. It won't take you very long to read through it. And if you can catch the whole context, I think it'll really help you. One of the problems we do is just take a little bitty chapter. Read the whole book if you can, and that'll give you a better picture of the landscape or the context in which we're dealing with. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place next week. God bless you.